Hello and welcome to Dialect from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all our listeners in Bristol, also on Preston FM 103.2, and also on Radio Verulam in St Albans, and also to our listeners in Swindon. Hello.
400 years ago, elected members would have went into the chamber with their swords. Back then, to stop them literally fighting each other with swords.
Yep, coming up in the programme, we have part two of Anthea Page's visit to Stormont, the Parliament buildings in Belfast. Our guest this week is Chris Betts. He's going to be here talking about his book, which is about the New World Order. And Tony Gosling continues with his feature on transport with Dave Wetzel.
Malcolm Grieve is having a welcome break this week, so you will instead hear Chapter 1 of The Road to Wigan Pier by George Orwell, just to remind people going through the present recession what life was really like before the Second World War in this country. We have Tim Burrows later on playing us some music, and Jeff Sparks is here in the studio with the What's On Guide. I'm John Peters Colman.
And I'm Michaela Dennis. Our studio guest this week is Chris Betts. Hi, Chris.
Hiya. How are you doing, Michaela?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. Tired, but good.
Good. Well, there's a reason you're tired. You have fairly recently put together a self-published book called Architects of Babylon, The Evil Behind the Intended New World Order. Mm-hmm. Now, some people may have heard you on Dialect a few months ago talking about this. It's come on a lot. And with a title like that, you're going to have to remind us what it's about.
Well, in very broad strokes, it's about the people who are trying to reshape the political alignments of the world. You can use the blanket term globalism. And the people who are that I refer to as the architects are the main movers behind that. The people that guys like William Still would refer to as the banksters or the money masters. And they spend huge budgets on swaying the public into accepting what initially are presented as trade agreements. Again, I'm having to paint in pretty broad strokes because I know that we can't go into great detail. People will have to buy the book, won't they? But the whole thing is largely sold to the people in the various countries as under the guise of trade agreements. So most people are familiar with, you know, terms like GATT and all these different things that have been advanced on the, you know, stateside. That's one aspect of it. We've had the same thing going back to our history, when we went into the European, what was originally called the European Economic Community, and it's just now termed the European Union, which is basically what the people I'm referring to have been trying to do for many, many, many years. But they're very patient. And I think David Icke's term, which I rather liked, was they execute their maneuvers by means of what he terms the totalitarian tiptoe, which I kind of like. It's incrementalism. A good British example would be if people want to look into the Fabian Group. Many people are familiar with the name, but the intent of that particular think tank come activist group is largely unknown to many people. And its logo, which I've included in the book, put an illustration in there. I think they've recently changed it to a turtle, but I'd have to check on that. The one that I show is the traditional one, which is a wolf with a sheep's fleece strapped around it. I can show you the illustration. And that gives you a good insight into the tactics that they use. They don't suddenly scare you with saying, we're going to do this, this and this. They do it by means of the totalitarian tiptoe.
So who is they? Give us an example of this group of individuals.
Well, the recent chairman was Tony Blair. Her eyebrows went up. Well, a lot of people don't know that, of course, because it's what they don't tell you that is the subject of what we have to dig into. I mean, I'm heartened by the fact that there are a great many people who have been in touch with me from all over the place. As I mentioned earlier, I mean, this weekend is far afield as Spain. People are investigating for themselves. And I think I mentioned earlier when we were chatting, the amount of research that I initially did, and I think John and I discussed this last time, it was a vast amount of research. The book could easily have been, you know, 6 volumes sort of thing. But that's not very user-friendly. And really, I don't see my role as spelling it all out for people. The idea behind what I've written is really to stimulate people to get digging themselves. And that's what I've found so heartening about the feedback that I've got.
So what are these people architecting, though? Presumably it's nefarious means. It's something we don't want. Like, why is it an issue? Why should we be worried?
Well, whenever you get great power blocks together they're easier to control. And the dream that these people generationally have harboured, what Hitler, for instance, tried to do by force, and Mosley, you'll be probably be aware of Oswald Mosley in the black shirts in this country, they were outmaneuvered in this country by the Fabians, who said, don't put the tanks on the street and try and make the whole thing a block. You know, don't try and create... The term that I've used in there is a one that's familiar to, you know, a growing number of people. The New World Order is what the insiders termed it, which is a block of aligning people together. You know, so like in Europe, to put the whole thing together, include Britain in it. So it's things like that. It's putting things together so that you have things like the European Union. Recently, the plans are quite advanced for the North American Union, which is Canada, Mexico, and the States. You will have heard of that. And they're not even being subtle about it. They put out the kind of smokescreen of this is a trade agreement, but it's really an attempt alongside that to put the nations into blocks so that you can make a global dominion.
And is that to repress the vast members of the public then, the populace? Is what's the kind of intention with that, to make people easier to control, to sell more, to make lots of money themselves?
Well, I'll give you perhaps the best way to approach that, Michaela, would be to give you some quotes. Sometimes I think that's the best thing, because then people can tag the name and look into it.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you this one. We shall have world government, whether or not you like it, by conquest or consent, James Warburg, and that was as far back as 1950. So it's not a recent thing. It's been going on for years. Countless people, H.G. Wells said, will hate the New World Order and will die protesting it, again, protesting against it. I don't know if you're aware of the filmmaker Aaron Russo. Let me give you a couple of things that people would immediately key into. Trading Places with Eddie Murphy. This is one of his. Very famous film producer and somebody who got on the wrong side of some of the established figures that we're talking about. And in an interview just before he died, he revealed that Nick Rockefeller, who was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations, the World Economic Forum, and the International Institute for Strategic Studies, he tried to befriend him because Aaron had done a film called Mad as Hell. I don't know if you've heard of that or seen it. It was a series of things that were televised in the States, and it caused a furor. It got a lot of people really thinking. And so Nick Rockefeller tried to befriend Aaron Russo. He was quite concerned that he got him on the right side of it. And in one of their conversations, I mean, I'll cut this short, the end goal, he said, is to get everybody chipped, to control the entire society, to have the bankers and the elite people control the world. So they're not, once they're in conversation with an individual they're trying to recruit, they're not exactly subtle about it. They're only subtle in the PR that they sell via the controlled media, you know, which most people lap up in front of the TV. We were talking in the green room earlier about the lady who's doing the swimming interview tonight, very interesting lady. The comment that she made was that I think she said she's got rid of her TV. And as we arrived here in Queen Square tonight, it was great. People were out there socializing and chatting on the green. They weren't stuck in front of a tube. But I think, again, I'm not saying TV's bad per se, but I am saying that there's a great deal of stuff that the TV, the media in general, is used to push into people's minds. And most people just sit there and veg out in front of the TV and accept it. And they're not aware of the levels which some of these agendas are on.
Just very briefly, because we haven't got very much time, unfortunately. Should we be worried? How pervasive is their control at the moment, then, this new world order that you've described?
Extremely pervasive. I'll give you, again, I'll try and keep it as topical as I can and keep it right to the point. Oliver Ullier. Who he, you might say, if you've not investigated him. He is Sarkozy's brainwashing guru. He's a behavioural expert. And alongside areas like organisations that people like Brian Gerrish have exposed, like Common Purpose is one of the organisations. But let me give you an insight into what they're about. Oliver Ullier has been asked to advise David Cameron's, I've got the name here, David Cameron's Behavioural Insight Team. The task is to formulate new ways to alter your attitudes and your behaviour. The insider jargon would include terms like nudging or reframing your outlook. The techniques include neuro-linguistic programming, which I'm sure some of your other guests have mentioned. And that's presently being used by organisations like Common Purpose in the training of police officers, civil servants and the like. So, yes, we should be worried. And I think it's not just a question of biting our nails and panicking, it's doing something about it. So if people are not clued into these things at all, you know, if they read my particular book, then great, they can go away. Or they can subscribe to Brian Gerrish and Mike Robinson's, they co-edit a thing called the UK Column, which is an excellent broadsheet.
How can people get hold of your book? I'm afraid we have to end it there, but
you can get it straight, we can get it direct, or you can get it straight off Amazon, the Amazon book.
Okay, so just to remind everybody, it's called Architects of Babylon, The Evil Behind the Intended New World Order, and it's by Chris Betts. Thank you very much, Chris.
It's a pleasure. Thanks a lot, Michaela.
Without it, London would be unthinkable. Queues everywhere and aggro every time you change trains or buses. I'm talking about the London Travel Card. It was introduced in the 1980s, and there may be a lot of lessons for public transport in Bristol when we realise lower fares can actually bring in more money. Dialect's Tony Gosling has been speaking to former bus conductor Dave Wetzel. He's the man who brought the public transport revolution from Paris to London. His passion now is land reform, and this bit of the interview explains how he got from transport to land reform.
Ever since the 1980s, when buses were first privatised, and then with the privatisation of the railways, we've seen disintegration. Instead of having an integrated public transport system, we've seen disintegration. The powers at local level are limited, but there are powers. You can have bus partnerships and agreements, and you can do deals with the railway operators, but it is limited, and you can't blame the people running these companies for wanting to make a profit, because that's what their shareholders expect of them. So what we need is a government that creates a completely different framework, a completely different set of rules, that recognises that with climate change, pollution, traffic congestion, the real answer to that is to have a nationally integrated public transport system where it's cheaper to go city to city by train rather than by taking a car, where it's cheaper and easier to commute by public transport rather than by car, to encourage the use of walking and cycling. A lot of it also depends upon land use planning, because if you close a lot of local hospitals and then say people have got to travel to one big hospital, then obviously you're going to create a lot more journeys. Now, many of those journeys could be by public transport, but usually a lot of those journeys, and I'm not thinking just of patients who need the treatment, but also visitors who are a part of somebody getting better, is having friends and family come and visit you. A lot of those people will want to come by car as well. So we need to think about keeping local facilities open, and of course that costs money, but it makes it a nicer society to live in, a nicer, happier community to live in. And one of the first objectives of transport planners should be to actually reduce the need for transport. And I strongly believe that land use planning and stopping urban sprawl is one way of achieving it. And here I have to move on to my interest in land reform, because if you introduce a tax on land values, it means that empty sites in towns like Bristol, cities like Bristol, are not going to be kept empty. What happens today is those empty shops, those empty offices, those empty sites force people that want to provide homes or want to provide jobs to look at cheaper sites farther afield that are available, And then, of course, you build houses on greenfield sites and you end up with urban sprawl. And I was only talking today about Taiwan. Taiwan has very little urban sprawl. And one of the reasons for that, the major reason, is the fact that they have a land value tax. And it costs landowners money to keep land idle. I think that's one of the big secrets to having livable cities, livable towns, and even livable villages. And once you start moving in that direction, other things can flow from it. A good public transport system. If you trebled the number of buses on one of the bus routes in Bristol and gave them complete expressways for the buses so that they don't get caught up in the traffic jams, what you'd find, as they indeed they found in Bogota when they did exactly this, is that all the land values around the bus stops all increase in value. And if you have a land value tax, you recoup the cost. And we just ignore it. When we built the Jubilee Line, when I say we, then when the taxpayers of Bristol paid for the Jubilee Line to be built in London, the land values around the 11 new stations went up by £13 billion. Well, it cost £3.5 billion to build. That was a huge gift to landowners from the taxpayers of Bristol and the rest of the country. Why do we do that? And yet it's tax-free. We don't even bother to tax the land. And if we did, we would collect some, and almost as much as we want, of that increased value back into the public purse to spend again on public transport. But when you run public transport just on a individual company basis, and you say to that individual company, you've got to make a profit, inevitably they're going to increase the fares to the point of diminishing returns. They're not going to run buses for social reasons unless they're subsidised to do so. That's a part of the capitalist system. It's a part of the free market system. What we need is a regulated market in transport, and we need the wealth that transport creates in terms of land value gets pumped back into transport.
But do you think there's any realistic possibility of that now with a Conservative government and the prospects for any kind of rolling back of the privatisation of transport seem pretty remote?
You're speaking to a born optimist. I've been banging my head against brick walls since the age of 16 in politics, and I still live in hopes. It's not even that we need a revolution, although personally I think that would be rather nice. But what we need is some reforms. And interestingly enough, I often think that maybe a Cameron-led government might be more likely to have the courage to do reforms. We certainly had 13 years of right-wing Labour governments that missed. Yeah, they did some good things. They introduced child credit and investment in hospitals and schools at tremendous cost using the private sector's PPP. But nevertheless, on the whole, they didn't introduce any major reform, certainly not in the fields of public transport. And so I actually think that it is quite possible that reform will come from where you least expect it. And if you start analysing what the condemned government is actually consisting of, you've got people within that government who are from the Liberal side who actually believe in land reform. They touched upon it in their manifesto that they put forward at the last election. They were going to change business rates. Instead of charging businesses on the value of their buildings, and if they made a building bigger or better or more beautiful, they would charge them a higher rate, which is what we do at the moment. They were going to put it on the land values. And that is a very important reform. They were going to bring in the mansion tax. So anybody, you know, £2 million was for the mansion tax. Anybody with a house worth more than £2 million. Well, it isn't the house, of course. It's the land, the location of that house that gives the £2 million. And who creates that value? It's the whole community around it. You can have a house in Knightsbridge worth £2 million, and if you up the, that actual same building and moved it to, I don't know, the foothills of Snowdonia, it wouldn't be worth a fraction of that. So it's not the building that has the value. Buildings cost, you have to employ people, you have to buy bricks and tiles for the roof and wooden floorboards, the rest of it. That is a cost. But houses don't sell for their cost and a modest profit to the builder or developer. What they sell for is the value of a location. People will pay more for a house that overlooks a lake or a sea view or a house which is close to good transport or a house in an area which has got very low crime. And the converse is true. Houses won't sell for a high sum in an area with high crime. A house next to the gas works on one side and I was going to say a steel firm on the other, but neither exist in today's economy. But you get the meaning that without beautiful views, that will sell for less. The value of a house is the location. That's the main value of a house. And we need to pump that wealth back into the community and create happier communities with less unemployment and more cohesion than we have at the moment. That's wider than a transport issue. It's about funding police, about funding the fire services, encouraging private businesses. Yeah, imagine you've got an office block and at lunchtime there's no hairdressers for the staff to use, there's no sandwich bars, there's no restaurants, there's no newspaper shops or sweet shops or clothes shops. The rent that the owner of the office block would get would be much, much less than if all these facilities exist. So private business also adds to land value. It's not just public enterprise. And all of us need to share that value.
That was former Chair of Transport at the Greater London Council, Dave Wetzel, with possibly some lessons to get Bristol's public transport working better. Next week, Dave explains how by taxing land, he believes society could be transformed.
We go over to Belfast now for part two of a visit to the seat of the Northern Irish Parliament at Stormont. Last week, our reporter Anthea Page was in the Great Hall, and this week we are now in the Senate Chamber, now mostly used for committee meetings.
So this is the Senate Chamber. Now, that's its official title, but it isn't used any longer as an upper house or a Senate Chamber. The reason being that up until 1972, we did have a government and opposition here, so anything would need to be ratified from an upper house. But these days we have, well, this is our third attempt at a power-sharing executive. So anything that is agreed between all the parties, which doesn't have an opposition within it, they're all working together. If it's agreed from within all the parties, it doesn't need an upper house to further rubber stamp. But that's a redundant exercise, you know. But it is a committee room these days, and a very grand committee room. That's why we have this outer table, the microphones and the television cameras. They're more recent additions. But everything else that you see in here, it is original from 1932. And possibly even older than that would be the two red dispatch boxes on the table here, which were gifted to us from the House of Lords, actually. The reason for dispatch boxes is if you see, for instance, say on BBC, David Cameron or any minister approaching the bench and leaning on the dispatch box. The reason being, well, these days there would be the Bible, the King James Version, the Torah and the Quran. Back then it would have been just the King James Bible. So once you're touching the box, you're under oath to God that you're telling the truth. That's the role of the dispatch box. The inner table here, you'll notice when we get across to the assembly chamber, there isn't a table and therefore no dispatch boxes. So therefore nothing to lean on to swear you're telling the truth. Once they cross into the chamber, they are under oath the whole time they're within the chamber. The reason why the table isn't there and therefore no dispatch boxes, it's the fire and the redesign. There is a significance, though, about the width of that table. It does go back to Westminster, which has been set up going over 400 years now. 400 years ago, elected members would have went into the chamber with their swords. But back then, to stop them literally fighting each other with swords, that table has to be the width of two swords pointed at each other, so it literally stops them fighting each other across the floor. Curtain behind the speaker's chair. Now, we'll have one across the way as well. Westminster have always had this. Going back hundreds of years again, you only ever had one Speaker of the House. You didn't have deputy speakers. And after a whole day, maybe even all night, when the members were standing talking, the one Speaker of the House would be, you know, bursting for the loo. He'd be like that. So he'd say, "All right, excuse me, members, sorry about this," but he'd pop around behind the curtain and he'd use the chamber pot that they would have in Westminster. Aye. But then back then, I suppose the smell of London, it wouldn't have mattered. But we don't have a toilet behind there now. It's the door for the speaker. They can't even use the same door as the members coming in and out. They have to remain neutral when they're in the chamber, so they have to have their own door as well. You may notice the four doors in the corners, the velvet curtains especially, leading into boxes that are closed off from the floor. The reason why they're closed off is those boxes were for officials and observers who could pass notes to the members, but they're not allowed to speak because they couldn't get out of the box to approach the dispatch boxes. Public gallery was actually up above, and on the ceiling of it, you might notice the three arabesque paintings. The one on the right-hand side represents really the only industry, apart from tourism, really these days, that we have left in this country. That represents farming. The one in the middle represents shipbuilding, obviously with Harland and Wolff. And the one on the left represents the linen industry, which was so vastly important here. The linen panels that we have around the walls here too. Irish damask linen that was produced in South Armagh, Glenann, that's where it was made. Pattern woven into it rather than printed on it, it's a very expensive process. But what we have here now is obviously for the tourist trade. Now the wooden furnishings and the wooden pillars, all walnut from the South African and Australian governments. And the glass in the ceiling, original as well, and that's from the Canadian government as well. We have up here then the Royal Standard with God at my right in French. Obviously that's the Norman French influence then with the royal family. But then the Norman term comes from Norsemen, who were Scandinavian in the first place, and they invaded France, and then they invaded up into England, and then across into Ireland. It was all about 800 years ago, of course. So if you have anybody whose name is Fitzwilliam or Fitzmaurice or Fitzpatrick or Fitzsimmons, the Fitz, it's a Norman name. Now it, of course, has the lion and the unicorn, the Royal Standard, as a mark of the sovereignty of the monarch over government here. We had 26 senators in here. 24 of them would have been elected by, you know, from the great and good of Northern Irish society by the Commons Chamber, as it was up until 1972. Two of them that always had a seat in here, no matter who they were, would have been the Lord Mayor of Belfast, that sat on the right of the Speaker, and the mayor of Derry, stroke Londonderry, stroke City, stroke Maiden City, would sit over there as well. Now, during the Second World War, this room was very different, actually. This is mainly Royal Air Force personnel that used this very chamber for what was the main operations centre for the entire Northern Atlantic sea defences, for the Battle of the North Atlantic, more or less. Below us, you have the Republic of Ireland, which was neutral, although Dublin was hit on a number of occasions by the Luftwaffe. Below that you had occupied France, which was obviously no-go. And then below that you had neutral Spain, but under the control of Franco. And of course the UK had to think about the approaches into the Mediterranean. And so there was really only here as a base on the Atlantic for the Allies. And I mean, taking into consideration, say, for example, our flying boats from the lakes in Fermanagh, they spotted the Bismarck, which was one of the ships along with the Donitz that was controlling the U-boats basically as well. And at that stage, when the Bismarck was sunk, Britain was almost, what, a fortnight away from starvation, nearly starved out of the war. So the U-boats were eventually in disarray, and then the convoys from the States and Canada were then able to get through along the Allied war effort. So vitally important here, really, Belfast and surrounding areas as well, where the American forces and also were based too here. But maybe not such a clever building to have such a room, because with the roads outside acting like a huge big arrow right up to the building, which is completely white, and on a big, big hill, you can see it for miles and miles around. Not very clever. So this is the outside of the building during the Second World War. Completely black. Obviously to protect it against night raids. Well, they couldn't afford, initially, to cover it completely in tar, bitumen tar. It would have been too damaging as well. So they mixed it 50-50 with cow manure. There were two hopes for that, you see. They wanted moss to cover the entire building, so it would be completely hidden, even though it was completely exposed. And also to get the tar off more easily after the war. The tar sealed the manure, so it stayed black, but the Luftwaffe raids were at night. We were never hit. Also, that other idea, they wanted it to be easier to clean it off after the war. It actually took 30 men 7 years by hand to clean it off. With the shipyards and the aircraft factory, of course, East Belfast was completely devastated. And they mistook the waterworks in North Belfast for the shipyards as well. And North Belfast was completely devastated also. We were the third most bombed city in the UK during the Second World War. I mean, even ahead of Glasgow, Coventry, Sheffield, you know, all the major industrial cities. It was London, then Liverpool, then us. Famous Belfast Blitz as well, you know. Because apparently what I learnt also quite recently is that in the early part of the war, London didn't think that Germany would be so daft as to maybe fly across England to reach Belfast. Much of the defences that we had here, they took over to London, you know, the anti-aircraft guns and things like that. But then, of course, they didn't take into account that they would take over France and then fly up the Irish Sea and then down Belfast Lock, so we were exposed.
Thank you, Anthea, for that report on Stormont, the parliamentary buildings in Belfast. And you can hear part three next week.
Well, now, just for a one-off, going to hear chapter one of The Road to Wigan Pier, read by Chris Worthington.
Road to Wigan Pier, chapter one. The first sound in the mornings was the clumping of the mill girls' clogs down the cobbled street. Earlier than that, I suppose, there were factory whistles, which I never awoke to hear. There were generally four of us in the bedroom, and a beastly place it was, with that defiled, impermanent look of rooms that are not serving their rightful purpose. Years earlier, the house had been an ordinary dwelling house, and when the Brookers had taken it and fitted it out as a tripe shop and lodging house, they had inherited some of the more useless pieces of furniture, and had never had the energy to remove them. We were therefore sleeping in what was still recognisably a drawing room. Hanging from the ceiling, there was a heavy glass chandelier on which the dust was so thick that it was like fur, and covering most of one wall, there was a huge, hideous piece of junk, something between a sideboard and a hall stand, with lots of carving and little drawers and strips of looking glass. And there was a once gaudy carpet ringed by the slop pails of years, and two gilt chairs with burst seats, and one of those old-fashioned horsehair armchairs which you slide off when you try to sit on them. The room had been turned into a bedroom by thrusting four squalid beds in amongst this other wreckage. My bed was in the right-hand corner, on the side nearest the door. There was another bed across the foot of it, and jammed hard against it, it had to be in that position to allow the door to open, so that I had to sleep with my legs doubled up. If I straightened them out, I kicked the occupant of the other bed in the small of the back. He was an elderly man named Mr. Riley, a mechanic of sorts, and employed on top at one of the coal pits. Luckily, he had to go to work at 5 in the morning, so I could uncoil my legs and had a couple of hours proper sleep after he was gone. In the bed opposite, there was a Scotch miner who had been injured in a pit accident. A huge chunk of stone pinned into the ground, and it was a couple of hours before they could lever it off, and had received £500 compensation. He was a big, handsome man of 40, with grizzled hair and a clipped moustache, more like a sergeant major than a miner, and he would lie in bed till late in the day, smoking a short pipe. The other bed was occupied by a succession of commercial travellers, newspaper canvassers and hire purchased touts, who generally stayed for a couple of nights. It was a double bed, and much the best in the room. I had slept in it myself my first night there, but had been manoeuvred out of it to make room for another lodger. I believe all newcomers spent their first night in the double bed, which was used, so to speak, as bait. All the windows were kept tight shut, with a red sandbag jammed in the bottom, and in the morning the room stank like a ferret's cage. You did not notice it when you got up, but if you went out of the room and came back, the smell hit you in the face with a smack. I never discovered how many bedrooms the house contained, but strange to say, there was a bathroom dating from before the Brookers' time. Downstairs, there was the usual living room with its huge open range burning day and night. It was lighted only by a skylight, for on one side of it was the shop, and on the other the larder, which opened into some dark subterranean place where the tripe was stored. Partly blocking the door of the larder, there was a shapeless sofa, upon which Mrs. Brooker, our landlady, lay permanently ill, festooned in grimy blankets. She had a big, pale, yellow, anxious face. No one knew for certain what was the matter with her. I suspect that her only real trouble was overeating. In front of the fire, there was almost always a line of damp washing, and in the middle of the room was a big kitchen table at which the family and all the lodgers ate. I never saw this table completely uncovered, but I saw its various wrappings at different times. At the bottom, there was a layer of old newspaper, stained by Worcester sauce. Above that, a sheet of sticky white oilcloth. Above that, a green serge cloth. Above that, a coarse linen cloth, never changed and seldom taken off. Generally, the crumbs from the breakfast were still on the table at supper. I used to get to know individual crumbs by sight and watch their progress up and down the table from day to day. The shop was a narrow, cold sort of room. On the outside of the window, few white letters, relics of ancient chocolate advertisements, were scattered like stars. Inside, there was a slab upon which the great white folds of tripe and the grey flocculent stuff known as black tripe and the ghostly translucent feet of pigs ready boiled. It was the ordinary tripe and pea shop, and not much else was stocked except bread, cigarettes and tinned stuff. Teas were advertised in the window, but if a customer demanded a cup of tea, he was usually put off with excuses. Mr. Brooker, although out of work for 2 years, was a miner by trade, but he and his wife had been keeping shops of various kinds as a sideline all their lives. At one time, they had had a pub, but they had lost their license for allowing gambling on the premises. I doubt whether any of their businesses had ever paid. They were the kind of people who run a business chiefly in order to have something to grumble about. Mr. Brooker was a dark, small-boned, sour, Irish-looking man, and astonishingly dirty. I don't think I ever once saw his hands clean. As Mrs. Brooker was now an invalid, he prepared most of the food. And like all people with permanently dirty hands, he had a peculiarly intimate, lingering manner of handling things. If he gave you a slice of bread and butter, there was always a black thumbprint on it. Even in the early morning, when he descended into the mysterious den behind Mrs. Brooker's sofa and fished out the tripe, his hands were already black. I heard dreadful stories from the other lodgers about the place where the tripe was kept. Black beetles were said to swarm there. I do not know how often fresh consignments of tripe were ordered, but it was at long intervals. Mrs. Brooker used to date the events by it. Let me see now. I've had 3 lots of frozen tripe since that happened, etc., etc. We lodgers were never given tripe to eat. At the time, I imagined that this was because tripe was too expensive. I have since thought that it was merely because we knew too much about it. The Brookers never ate tripe themselves, I noticed. The only permanent lodgers were the Scotch miner, Mr. Riley, 2 old-age pensioners, and an unemployed man on the PAC named Joe. He was the kind of person who has no surname. The Scotch miner was a bore when you got to know him. Like so many unemployed men, he spent too much time reading newspapers, and if you did not head him off, he would discourse for hours about such things as the Yellow Peril, trunk murders, astrology, and the conflict between religion and science. The age-old pensioners had, as usual, been driven from their homes by the means test. They handed their weekly 10 shillings over to the Brookers, and in return got the kind of accommodation you would expect for 10 shillings, that is, a bed in the attic, meals chiefly of bread and butter. One of them was of a superior type and was dying of some malignant disease, cancer, I believe. He only got out of bed on days when he went to draw his pension. The other, called by everyone Old Jack, was an ex-miner aged 78 who would work well over 50 years in the pits. He was alert and intelligent, but curiously enough, he seemed only to remember his boyhood experiences and to have forgotten all about the modern mining machinery and improvements. He used to tell me tales of fights with savage horses in the narrow galleries underground. When he heard that I was arranging to go down several coal mines, he was contemptuous and declared that a man of my size, 6'2½", would never manage the travelling. It was no use telling him that the travelling was better than it used to be. But he was friendly to everyone, and used to give us all a fine shout of good night, boys, as he crawled up the stairs to his bed somewhere under the rafters. What I most admired about Old Jack was that he never cadged. He was generally out of tobacco towards the end of the week, but he always refused to smoke anybody else's. The Brookers had insured the lives of both old-age pensioners with one of the tanner-a-week companies. It was said that they were overheard anxiously asking the insurance tout how long people lived when they got cancer. Joe, like the Scotchman, was a great reader of newspapers and spent almost his entire day in the public library. He was the typical unmarried, unemployed man, a derelict-looking, frankly ragged creature with a round, almost childish face on which there was a naively naughty expression. He looked more like a neglected little boy than a grown-up man. I suppose it is the complete lack of responsibility that makes so many of these men look younger than their ages. From Joe's appearance, I took him to be about 28 and was amazed to learn that he was 43. He had a love of resounding phrases and was very proud of the astuteness with which he had avoided getting married. His total income was 15 shillings a week, and he paid out 6 or 7 to the Brookers for his bed. I sometimes used to see him making himself a cup of tea over the kitchen fire, but for the rest, he got his meals somewhere out of doors. It was mostly slices of bread and marge and packets of fish and chips. Besides, these were a floating clientele of commercial travellers, of the poorer sort, travelling actors, always common in the north, because most of the larger pubs hire variety artists at the weekends, and newspaper canvassers. The newspaper canvassers were a type I had never met before. Their job seemed to me so hopeless, so appalling, that I wondered how anyone could put up with such a thing when prison was a possible alternative. They were employed mostly by weekly or Sunday papers, and they were sent from town to town, provided with maps and given a list of streets that they had to work each day. If they failed to secure a minimum of 20 orders a day, they got the sack. So long as they kept up their 20 orders a day, they received a small salary, £2 a week, I think, on any order over the 20 they drew as tiny commission. The thing is not so impossible as it sounds, because in working class districts, every family takes in a tuppenny weekly paper and changes it every few weeks. But I doubt whether anyone keeps a job of that kind long. The newspapers engage poor, desperate wretches, out-of-work clerks, commercial travellers and the like, who for a while make frantic efforts to keep their sales up to the minimum. Then, as the deadly work wears them out, they are sacked and fresh men are taken on. I got to know two who were employed by one of the more notorious weeklies. Both of them were middle-aged men with families to support, and one of them was a grandfather. They were on their feet 10 hours a day, working their appointed streets, and then busy late into the night, filling in blank forms for some swindle their paper was running. One of those schemes by which you are given a set of crockery if you take out a 6-week subscription and sent a 2-shilling postal order as well. The fat one, the grandfather, used to fall asleep with his head on a pile of forms. Neither of them could afford the pound a week which the Brookers charged for full board. They used to pay a small sum for their beds and make shamefaced meals in a corner of the kitchen off bacon and bread and margarine, which they stored in their suitcases. The Brookers had a large number of sons and daughters, most of whom had long since fled from home. Some were in Canada, at Canada, as Mrs. Brooker used to put it. There was only one son living nearby, a large, pig-like young man, employed in a garage, who frequently came to the house for his meals. His wife was there all day with the two children, and most of the cooking and laundering was done by her and by Emmy, the fiancée of another son, who was in London. Emmy was a fair-haired, sharp-nosed, unhappy-looking girl who worked at one of the mills for some starvation wage, but nevertheless spent all her evenings in bondage at the broker's house. I gathered that the marriage was constantly being postponed and would probably never take place, but Mrs. Brooker had already appropriated Emmy as a daughter-in-law and nagged her in that particular watchful, loving way that invalids have. The rest of the housework was done, or not done, by Mr. Brooker. Mrs. Brooker seldom rose from her sofa in the kitchen. She spent the night there as well as the day and was too ill to do anything except eat stupendous meals. It was Mr. Brooker who attended to the shop, gave the lodgers their food, and did out the bedrooms. He was always moving with incredible slowness from one hated job to another. And at any hour of the day, you were liable to meet Mr. Brooker on the stairs, carrying a full chamber pot, which he gripped with his thumb well over the rim. In the mornings, he sat by the fire with a tub of filthy water, peeling potatoes at the speed of a slow-motion picture. I never saw anyone who could peel potatoes with quite such an air of brooding resentment. You could see the hatred of this bloody woman's work, as he called it, fermenting inside him, a kind of bitter juice. He was one of those people who can chew their grievances like a cud.
That was chapter one of The Road to Wigan Pier by George Orwell, published in 1937. It was read by Chris Worthington. Hopefully next week we will be returning to the exotic world of the Near East as we continue with Lady Hester Stanhope's travels across the desert lands.
Life, it seems a maze, a tangle so extreme, no beginnings and no endings, no cozy in-betweens. Blood is thicker than water, and would it burn so bright? But love, she takes us higher through the darkest night. When you're standing in the ruins of another broken dream, another lost adventure, another tragic ending scene. Life is burning down worries and endless troubles, they blow it down so low. Blood is thicker than water, and would it burn so bright? But love, she takes us higher through the darkest night.
We have Jeff Sparks in the studio with his What's On Guide.
Thank you. Hello, this is your What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Thursday, 12th of April, Mark Venus Music presents Alien Stash Tin with support from the Humanitarians at the Pilgrim Inn in Holywood Road, Brislington, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts around 9 p.m. Into Friday, 13th of April, the ZZ Tops will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol at Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £10 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Stockyard Stoics. This group came from Brooklyn in New York and released two albums before splitting up. This is from their second album titled Catastrophe, which was released in 2004, and is the track City Lights.
Thank you. righteous gasping in the glow of the left out down the line.
That was Stockyard Stoics with City Lights from the album Catastrophe. Into Saturday, 14th of April, the Genesis tribute, The Book of Genesis, will be performing at the Horn in Victoria Street, St Albans. Tickets are £8 in advance and £10 on the door, and doors open at 9 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 15th of April, Rainy and the Dust will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door, and doors open at 9 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening, and have a good week. Take care, and goodbye.
Thank you, Jeff. That's all from Dialect this week. Our studio guest was Chris Betts. Chris Worthington read us a chapter of The Road to Wigan Pier by George Orwell.
Tim Burrows read us some of his poetry, and there was a Watson Guide by Jess Sparks. The features were by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling, and the presenters were myself, John Peters Coleman.
And me, Michaela Dennis.
And the producer was Anthony Page, and the engineer was Michael Noyes. Goodbye.
To me, meet me down by the gallows tree, for it's sad news I bring about this old town and all that it's offering. Some say troubles abound. Someday soon they're gonna pull the old town down. One day we'll return here when the Belfast child sings again. Brothers, sisters, where are you now? As I look for you right through the crowd, all my life here I've spent with my faith in God and church and the government. Some say troubles abound. Someday soon they're gonna pull the old town down. One day we'll return here when the Belfast child sings again. When the Belfast child sings again. Thank you.
When the Belfast child sings again.